Welcome back. You're listening to Todd Smart Talk with Steve-O. This is News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Everyone knows the sound of that theme, the song, Bewitched, right, Machine?
That is correct.
It is correct. And do you know why we're playing that for our guest here?
You'll have to tell me.
I will have to tell. And he's sitting here going, I'm here to do an interview. What are you doing playing Bewitched? Well, in the early years of Bewitched, which was on from 64 to 72, the lead character...
Darren Stevens,
originally Dick York, later Dick Sargent. He was an ad guy. And that's that's what inspired the young Steve-O to get involved with advertising. So with that, let me go with a formal introduction. Please welcome Tim Nudd. He's the senior editor for Adweek. He also writes and is involved with journalism in a number of publications, but he's in here today talking about advertising and the publishing business involving the creative side of the industry. Tim, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Steve.
Did you recognize the Bewitched song? Did that have any meaning for you?
Took me a few bars, but I did recognize it after a while.
Yeah,
I haven't watched that show in a long time.
Yeah, it's one of those shows where I think you have to get into the 400 or 500 range of your cable box. You need a lot of altitude because then when I got into getting the song ready for the show, it was like everything else on Wikipedia. You find too much information, you don't know where to stop,
yeah.
Right? Like, you know, the first 5 years were in black and white, and then certain ones were in color, and then Elizabeth Montgomery had a contract dispute in 1968. But anyhow, I wondered
if you were going to do the Mad Men theme instead. A little more recognizable these days.
I know. That would have been the low-hanging fruit.
That's true. Other radio interviews you've done.
You
don't want to go with the obvious one.
No, because I want that question, that line of whole questioning about Mad Men, which is obviously this pop culture iconic show. I want that subject to be fresh. I don't want to lose it on the intro music.
That's a good point.
That's the way we roll here at WLOB on big operations like this. You may be used to smaller kind of broadcast situations. This is how we roll here.
Right, sure.
If you wouldn't mind, let's talk a little bit. You live in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, which I think is in itself always unique when I talk to business leaders or professional leaders in different areas when they operate and live out of Maine, what seemingly feels like is a quality of life choice.
Mm-hmm.
But with your journalistic credentials to find somebody like yourself and other people that I've talked to living in Maine, it's always kind of interesting. So if you wouldn't mind, spend a minute or two just talking a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and what brought you to Maine. And
sure.
Then we'll talk about the Adweek thing.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, I was actually born in England, and then my family moved to Illinois when I was a kid. So,
what part of England were you born?
I was born outside London, so I've got dual citizenship now.
Have you ever been to the Isle of Wight?
I have never been there, although my grandmother honeymooned there.
Really?
In the Abbey that was made famous in that book by Tony Hendra, that Father Joe book. So I've not been to the Isle of Wight, but I do have a bit of a family history with the Isle of Wight.
I was over in London and over in Ireland last year, and I was researching. I live in Yarmouth, right up the road, and I'm chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council. So going over there, researching kind of the genealogy of most town names originate from the old country, from England.
Right.
So I'm like, let me see the history of Yarmouth, England.
Right.
And it's in the Isle of Wight. And so I sent an email just randomly to the mayor of Yarmouth, and I went over and visited him. You take a train, then a ferry, then you grab a horse, and then you go through the woods, and you finally get there. And it was a lovely visit. It's all I have to do now is go down to Cape Cod and visit Yarmouth, Cape Cod,
and
then Nova Scotia, and I'll touch all the Yarmouth bases.
Yeah, I think Cape Elizabeth, I think, is named after Elizabeth I.
All of it. Like Falmouth is over something. So, I mean, I think it's all about the early.
It's called New England for a reason, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, that was the extent of the creativity. Well, we came from England. This place, why don't we just call this New England?
Yeah. So I grew up in the Midwest, and I ended up down in St. Louis for a while at Washington University. And then, you know, as we all did 20 years ago, I went to New York to look for work in publishing after college, and met my lovely wife there. And she's from South Portland. And
me too. I met my lovely wife down in Atlanta, and if it wasn't for the love of a good woman, I'd still be in Atlanta.
I'd be in New York paying way too much for way too little space.
Wow.
For sure.
So when you went to New York, were you specifically interested in one genre of writing, or was your interest just in literature and writing, and then you gravitated to different subjects and genres?
my interest was in making any money that would allow me to pay rent at first. So I started out actually writing about oil and gas, the energy business, briefly. For about 3 years when I first got there, I worked for a small publication called Petroleum Intelligence Weekly, which is sort of, they call it the Bible of the oil industry. It's subscribed to by about...
I love that magazine.
Maybe 3,000 people tops, oil companies and Mideast governments mostly.
Yeah.
And it was a fascinating experience, but I sort of got out of it as soon as I could because I was much more interested in creativity as a topic. And, you know, in the last 10 years or so, obviously creativity has become sort of this mantra, you know, from Freakonomics on, this kind of idea of thinking creatively, you know, and how that can solve all sorts of business problems. So, you know, a job came up at Adweek, and I've been contributing to Adweek on and off since 1997. And it's been great. I mean, it's been amazing to watch the business grow. And creativity is really the subject of my journalism.
I mean, you write for also, you're a contributing writer for People magazine and a number of other publications. So talk a little bit about, and I do want to focus on the advertising side, but in 2014, is it more common for writers and guest editors and feature editors to be kind of non-exclusive as opposed to being as part of a masthead where everything is paid for and you just stay with Sports Illustrated? And in your case, you write for a number of magazines. And so is that a trend in the industry, or is that just the way that you've kind of managed your career where you want the flexibility to write for different magazines?
I think it is a trend. I mean, I think a lot of my friends have done similar things that I've done. I am actually on staff at Adweek, so I do have a full-time gig with them, which is great. It's sort of what allowed me to move up here, actually. But yeah, I contribute to other places too. And I think, you know, these days, journalists can really, in their off hours, can certainly easily reach out to other places. And whatever you're interested in nowadays, you can almost get a story published anywhere if you have the time to do the legwork on it. So I feel pretty blessed to be able to live up here and have, you know, these ties to these New York magazines, which help me sort of make a living up here, which is nice.
I mean, basically, if you're working at your computer and you're interviewing people by phone and you're jetting in and out to interview people, you could be in New York City or you could be in Maine and still kind of function in the role of writer or editor and all the stuff you're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a manager, it's harder to do that. And, you know, there's certainly been questions about this working from home thing with Marissa Mayer at Yahoo questioned this last year. And, you know, I think there are legitimate downsides to it, but I think productivity-wise, if you're the right kind of person, you can get more done.
Didn't she change the policy there? I mean, she's famous for coming in, and when she came in, I think she was like 6 or 7 months pregnant. She went on like a 3-minute maternity leave. Then
she
came. She
had a nursery next to her office, I think.
Which is kind of funny.
People didn't take kindly to.
it
was easy for her to come to work because she could bring her baby with her.
Well, that and between her, I think her husband is some sort of capital investment guy or some sort of startup angel, whatever they call it out there. But I think with their combined $30 or $40 million a year, they had probably
they had some help.
As they say in California, they had a little bit of help.
Right. Well, you know, my wife and I, we had our first child back in 2008, and after about 6 months, we realized we need to change a plan here, just for our living situation.
Were you living in New York, or you were living in one of the suburbs?
We were living in Manhattan, so we had a super tight squeeze into our apartment, and it was, you know, we just started looking. Places to go, and she, you know, she's from here, her family's here, and we thought, wouldn't that be great if we could make that work? Luckily, it was a month or so before the Lehman Brothers collapse and the whole sort of downward spiral of late 2008 economy. So I was able to convince Adweek to let me come up here.
So you kind of just melted into the outflux of people jumping out of Manhattan as Manhattan was melting down. You kind of snuck into the crowd.
That's right. Yeah, we jumped into the boats and came up here.
That's funny.
It's been working great, though. I mean, it's almost 6 years now and 5.5 years, and I feel super productive working from here. I mean, I go down to New York every few weeks for a couple of days, but not much more than that.
Tell me something. Even though this airs on the AM powerhouse here in town, WLOB, and then it goes on the web, and obviously it's worldwide, but just between you and I've been going to New York City for 40 years professionally, and I'm down there every few weeks meeting with clients, and when I land in, whether it's LaGuardia, or I was just actually in Newark 2 days ago, but when I land in LaGuardia or JFK, I start getting this nervous twitch, and then I get out to the taxi cab line, and it turns into something a little more pronounced. And then after riding in a taxi and having my head hit the ceiling and hit the side and the guy swerving, by the time I get to the city, I just want to leave. And I understand for some people, there's great food and there's great opportunity and there's an energy. But my theory is for some people, they're either plugged into the energy and they really just are huge, big advocates of, oh, it's so wonderful. But for me, it just sucks out the energy. And what was your case in terms of living in the city and functioning and all that?
You know, I lived in Brooklyn for 3 years and in Manhattan for 11. So I was there for a long time. And the 11 years in Manhattan was longer than I had lived anywhere. And it really sort of became my home. And it was a little bit odd to leave, actually. Although you mentioned that kind of feeling coming in from the airport, and the whole time I lived there, for sure, if I would take a vacation, I would come back, and you would certainly feel that stress level kind of rise again. Yeah. I think you kind of have to be, you have to take that and sort of use it, I guess. Have the type of personality that you're going to.
But it just feels like it's like this Darwinistic thing where when you're in the city, even when you're thinking about going out for coffee, and most big office buildings have coffee shops in them and stuff, but if you're thinking about going to lunch, you've got to mentally kind of go, okay, great, I'm going to go two blocks, I'm going to take a right, I'm going to walk into people, I'm going to avoid eye contact with a few thousand people, I'm going to bump into a couple people, somebody's going to ask me for something that I ignore. Mm-hmm. You put so much energy when you're in New York City to avoiding things or avoiding humanity or clashing with humanity or something, that for me, and maybe it's because I'm kind of a small, timid guy, that may be part of my own personal thing.
I think there's an interesting thing that happens to people who live in New York, I think, where at some point, either after 3 months or 6 months or 6 years, or at some point, if you live there long enough, you feel like it's yours in a way. And
because you craft your own experience of where you live, where you eat,
exactly,
where you walk in Central Park,
exactly,
and all that.
And it becomes like you feel completely comfortable and at home. And in a way, being in that size of a city with that many people and feeling completely comfortable is a pretty kind of rare experience. I think people get, people who are not from there kind of fall in love with that a little bit.
Yeah. By the way, we have Tim Nutt here in the studio. Tim is the senior editor at Adweek, which, whether or not you're in the advertising, marketing, or communications business or not, it's, to me, a fascinating magazine because I think it reflects and covers much of pop culture. And Adweek is at www.adweek.com. Go online. He also writes for People magazine as a contributor writer. He's also an editor of adfreak.com, which is an online site.
Adweek's daily blog.
Yep. Fantastic. Yep. Well, so you ended up here in Maine. You ended up in Cape Elizabeth, beautiful Cape Elizabeth. Let's talk about specifically about advertising, because selfishly, as I mentioned to you when I was walking in from the lobby and with the whole Bewitched intro, to me, I've always been fascinated about advertising. I've worked with big ad shops. I've worked in small ad shops. And there's the psychology to advertising. There's the art of creating advertising, whether it's in a visual form or an audio form or motion or anything like that. Since you've worked writing for Adweek for so long, is there something about advertising and writing about advertising that you've gravitated to, or is it basically you've worked at Adweek, so that's kind of the genre you cover? Or how does it kind of talk to you in terms of your writing in covering this this area of life and business?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the thing that fascinates me about advertising is it doesn't get a lot of respect as a creative form. And, you know, if you're a screenwriter or you're a fine artist, you know, you have all this credibility. And if you're a copywriter or an art director, you know, you don't have that necessarily. And yet, you know, an enormous number of people come out of art school and end up in advertising. And there's this talent pool there, and they're producing some of the most innovative creative work in the world. And yet they're not really, they don't get that much respect for it in a way.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's because that there's a mercantile end to what they're doing, and that in some people's eyes sort of diminishes it a little bit. But if you can get past that, and if you can cover it as a creative business, I think it's just it's never ending opportunity for these people. And for a journalist, it's sort of nice to be covering a part of the creative world that isn't sort of overrun by all the major media too. So there are things going on in the space that are you know, I can get an exclusive on, you know, fairly easily because of my position. And a lot of these things are whether you're talking about Google or some of the more creative ad shops in the country, the product may be something that people claim not to like. And yet, at the same time, you know, the talent that goes into creating these products and these commercials and these different campaigns is amazing. And I've sort of fallen in love with this, you know, this business just because of that, just because of the talent that works in it. And
yeah, I think you just mentioned it's talent because it's not really institutional. It's talent. And when you look at like Whedon Kennedy or you look at Crispin Down, there are personalities there that kind of transcend the industry of just working for an advertising agency. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the stories you've done about the personalities in advertising, because some of them are larger than life figures that more than just conveying product information or more than just conveying kind of transactional commerce, like go buy this car or go use this laundry detergent. Advertising has for many, many decades, really since mass media came online, really influenced, shaped pop culture, shaped our lives, has just shaped human behavior. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it's come from different interesting people. Like you weren't around to interview like Leo Burnett, who's this famous, iconic guy.
Right.
But talk about some of the people you've met and how you think individual agency leadership has really, how that talent works its way into the creative.
Yeah. Well, two guys come to mind immediately, Dan Wyden of Wyden & Kennedy, also Jeff Goodby of Goodby Silverstein. So these two guys, both out on the West Coast, Wyden & Kennedy's very famous agency. They sort of made their name through the iconic Nike campaigns through the years. And, you know, you talk to Dan Wyden, and he's this, you know, he's not a hippie exactly, but he's, you know, he's just such an iconoclast out there. And he could have made millions, tens of millions if he had sold his agency, but he didn't. You know, he didn't want to sell to anybody. And he's, you know, he's an amazing person. And he's the guy that came up with the line, Just Do It, right? Which is 25 years old, I think last year now at this point. But, you know, I spoke to him at one point and he had the craziest story about how he came up with Just Do It. I don't know if you've heard that story.
No, why don't you tell the story? That's interesting.
So this was late 80s, I think, 1988. And, you know, Wyden's coming out. Wyden's been working with Nike for a little while, but they've got this big TV campaign coming out.
And Nike at that point wasn't really the Nike.
It came from
University of Oregon. Coach, what's his name, Bowerman, who, did, you know, the movie Prefontaine showed a little bit about that sign.
Yep.
But it was the first wave of big shoe companies, so this was really part of the first wave, right?
Right, right. And you know, you still had, as far as TV commercials, you were still squarely in the 80s, that whole 80s look and feel to TV ads. And, you know, Nike really needed, they had a bunch of different spots coming out that month, and they needed sort of a unifying theme to these ads. And you know, it's the night before, I mean, it's one of these crazy advertising stories, the night before he needs to send the work to Nike for approval, and you know, he just can't think of anything. And then suddenly out of nowhere, the creative process, right? Like he remembers back to Gary Gilmore. Now, this is probably a story Nike doesn't want you to hear. But, you know, this murderer who's executed about a decade before out in California. And asked for his last words before he was shot by the firing squad. He said, let's do it.
Let's do it. Wow.
And Dan said, it always stuck with me, the sort of bravado of that and you know, the no-nonsense kind of...
And the simplicity. It's like, you know, it's so short and the words are so...
And he said he changed it from let's do it to just do it so that Gilmore's family wouldn't have a claim on him.
Wow. That's a great story. When you say Gilmore, obviously people revert to Happy Gilmore, which in recent time has gotten more fame.
This was not Happy Gilmore.
Yeah. So that was the era when, like, Phil Knight, who was one of the founder, but he had some other people working with him on the Nike, and then Paul Fireman, Reebok in Stoughton, Mass., or just outside of Boston. But that's an exciting story. Just do it.
You know, I mean, and it obviously went on to become if not the greatest, one of the greatest marketing taglines in history.
Yeah, and it may have been like Puma, and I don't even know what their mark. They're kind of a European company, but yeah. There were so many shoe companies back then mm-hmm. that part of it was the ethos, I think, of Nike, and mm-hmm. part of it was just the Northwest culture.
Yeah,
but part of it was the agency, Weedon & Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
They had that sensibility in the Northwest. It wasn't
That's
a
true.
New York kind of slick thing. It
yep.
wasn't like, hey, we're going to do it this way. They kind of felt the environment that Nike was born from.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about that positioning, it's a fascinating thing. It's not about the shoes. It's about motivation. It's about human desire for self-improvement. And it's not a very – if you really pick apart that line, it's such a simple line, but there's so much going on in it.
And the execution, whenever you look back at those early spots, just do it. It really tapped into kind of the human spirit,
mm-hmm.
and everyone could relate to their own story of just do it.
That's
you
right.
know, play a sport, just do it, get in better shape, get healthy, overcome some sort of health obstacle. Just do it, no excuses. And that's the funny thing about great copy, mm-hmm. and much like great writing, there's a famous I wrote a column for Knight Ridder for a number of years, and I had this editor, which, you know, I want like to get your thoughts on editors, because we used to call them drones. And every time I would put in like some sort of Pulitzer Prize winning thing, the drone would come back and hack it up, and I'd be like, what are you doing? And the saying is, if I had more time, I would have made the piece shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And great copy is like that. Whereas if you had more time, it would have been, you know, just do it and feel the spirit of the shoe. But
right.
instead it was, oh, yeah, the Gary Gilmore thing.
Instead of got milk, it would be, do you have milk?
Yeah. Got milk is another great example where it's unnatural to try to combine those two words.
Mm-hmm.
And it's illiterate to begin with, right? And it doesn't. It's missing
right.
something,
just
a
like
verb,
think,
an adverb.
Just like Think Different was with Apple.
Yeah, so it's missing something. And so why even put punctuation at the end? Because gut milk just doesn't,
right.
doesn't. It's not even a construct. But those two words are just so.
Yeah.
So other than.
Well, that was the other guy I wanted to speak
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Was Jeff Goodby, who wrote Got Milk. And I saw Jeff last week at South by Southwest and caught up with him a little bit. And, you know, it's interesting because Got Milk now is sort of on its way out nationally as a national tagline. The National Milk Board is no longer going to be using that line. But Jeff came up with it for the California board, and the state board is still going to be using it. So he's a little bit bent out of shape, to be honest, about all these stories in the media about how got milk is dead, because it's not actually.
Well, in California, if it was a country, it would be like the eighth biggest country or something
right,
in the world.
Right.
So it's still
That's
this
right.
huge market, right?
It is, yeah. But it was an interesting thing because he came up with Got Milk, sort of a similar story, you know, with kind of like last minute, as all agency creatives like to do things last minute. He sort of came up with that line, you know, on a napkin or whatever, however long ago that was. I think that was 1993. So that's another one that's been around for 20 years plus.
Wow.
But, you know, Jeff's another interesting guy. I mean, in his 60s now, the ponytail, the image of the creative, you know, the creative guy, the kind of hippie creative dude. He did, however, sell his agency to Omnicom, so he can't be, he's not an independent.
Whoa.
But.
That we had a rule here, Tim, not to mention Omnicom.
Right.
We had it. There was only one rule.
The O word.
There was only one
that.
Word. I'm kidding. I actually used to work with Omnicom, and they're an interesting multi-billion-dollar conglomerate.
They are.
That has an interesting way of showing appreciation for key personnel.
Huh.
Diplomatic.
Yeah.
Very
well,
thought.
They're even bigger now. They just merged with Publicis.
Publicis.
So, yeah.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit from your experience starting to write. We have Tim Nutt here. He's the senior editor for Adweek, in addition to being a writer for a number of magazines, who happens to live in Cape Elizabeth. From what you've seen in the business in terms of consolidation, like mm-hmm. we just talked about creativity, and we just talked about two iconic people that you know personally and you interviewed personally, how do you think that works in the world of kind of conglomerate machinery,
mm-hmm.
and in your coverage, how is that reflected in terms of stories that Adweek is doing relative to giant conglomerates and billion-dollar corporations versus, because when it comes right down to it, in those two cases of Just Do It for the campaign for Nike and Gut Milk, it wasn't a giant corporation that did it. It was some guy, or it could have been just easily some woman in advertising, late at night, late on a deadline, you know, who had procrastinated probably for a couple of weeks in the assignment, and then 11 o'clock in a fit of fatigue and kind of creativity came up with it. How do you think individual creativity meshes with giant corporate machinery?
Yeah, you know, I mean, ad industry mergers are never about making better advertising. It's not about being more creative. It's about creating value for shareholders, right? So, the old question has always been in advertising and any creative business is, you know, how big do you get before you get bad? And all these guys who are creatives, I think they, you know, when they sell their agency to a holding company, they're making a deal with the devil, and they know they are, and they can't help themselves. But it rarely does it improve the work. And you know, I'm not an expert on the business side of advertising, but creatively, I've watched it happen over and over where, you know, an agency is young, has some spark, has a ton of good talent. They sell to somebody, and suddenly it gets mucked up. You know, it's never the same again. And I think Dan Wyden recognized that, and you know, he would never sell. Stan Richards, again, another guy who runs an agency in Dallas called the Richards Group, another, you know, singular kind of guy in the business, and he never sold either for the same reason. I think he's even has it in his succession plan. Nobody can ever sell.
Wow.
So there are certain guys in the business who, you know, it's hard to have, you know, a certain amount of ethics when a lot of money's on the line, right? I mean, you've got your family to think about, and these people who are supremely talented, they probably should be paid for their talents in the form of, you know, they should be able to sell their agency. And a lot of guys did. You know, Lee Clow and Jay Shiat sold Shiat Day, you know, Apple's longtime agency in the early 90s, I think.
And who's the guy who had the TV show on CNBC, the famous guy in New York? God, I can't remember him. He had, like, this talk show, and he had a big agency.
Donny Deutsch.
Yeah, Donny Deutsch.
Yeah, sure. You know. Yeah, I mean, he got $250 million personally for his agency. You know, and he's not a guy who would have turned it down in the first place, though.
No, he feels like he enjoys it. From the outside looking in, he does enjoy it. He feels like he's a guy who takes some sort of pleasure in it. We have Tim Nutt here. He is an acclaimed journalist in multiple genres, but he's here talking about his work with Adweek, which is kind of the magazine of record for advertising, marketing, communications, and he happens to live in Cape Elizabeth, which I think is great. Now let's move on to a whimsical question, which you probably get asked all the time on airplanes and at family gatherings with uncles that you barely remember. What are your top three TV ads of all time that kind of stand out? And I'll give you mine. And I'd like to hear yours, both from a technical and kind of a social sense of what you think are just really powerful or that you enjoy.
That's a great question. I don't get that asked enough to where I have a rote answer. No.
Wow.
You know, I saw this was not a typical TV commercial, but there was a commercial a couple of years back for Johnny Walker, starring Robert Carlyle, the guy from Full Monty and Trainspotting. I thought it was a fascinating ad because they filmed it in the Highlands up in Scotland, and they basically took the most boring page of the website, right, which is the history page, the About Us page of Johnny Walker, and they created a monologue for Robert Carlyle, and he did it all in one take. It was a 5-minute video.
Wow.
Walking through the Scottish Highlands with a camera on him, and all along the way there are props. So there's TVs, a stack of TVs here. There's a bartender here. He walks through the door at another point. So it all had to be timed too. And he's basically, so the camera's on him. The camera's moving back. He's walking towards you, and it's this fascinating 5-minute video that I thought was conceptually incredible, and executed like flawlessly. And you know, the writing, the acting, the way it was shot, the way it was
the sound,
framed,
everything.
I mean, everything.
It's like a symphony. When you see
perfect.
A good piece of art like that, you're almost unaware of all the elements, like the lighting, the depth of feel, the perspective.
Mm-hmm. It was perfect. I thought it was perfect.
Wow.
You know, people who saw this year's Super Bowl, I'd be curious to hear what people think about the, you know, the Budweiser Puppy Love commercial, which did so well. I thought that, you know, that got some flack for, you know, being maybe a little sentimental.
Inner animal breeding, did it get some flack for what?
Well, it was well loved, but I think in the business, people saw it as kind of an easy, you know, low hanging fruit kind of thing.
I worked in the beer business years ago, and I was headed up a group that was part of Y&R that did Miller Brewing Company sports marketing. So I spent a lot of time at Miller, and it's really challenging for the beer and alcohol companies to promote in market with the legal guidelines and kind of the moral ethical parameters that they want to kind of meet in terms of not wanting to promote overuse of their products, because mm-hmm. you know, when used, you know, as directed, mm-hmm. which would be, you know, don't operate a vehicle, mm-hmm. it's fine if somebody wants to have a glass of wine, have a beer,
yep.
but to you know, with, you know, around the Super Bowl, a lot of the humanity that was connected to the product of Budweiser, if you could kind of reverse the camera from the TV side and look at the people at the Super Bowl parties, probably didn't have that feel-good, kind of tranquil mm-hmm. dog horse. There were probably a lot of really rowdy parties, people falling down, screaming
right.
at the
TV. Right.
It trying to personalize or humanize through animals mm-hmm. the experience of a warm Budweiser thing.
That's interesting.
It's kind of an interesting. Well, let me give you one of mine before I ask you for your number three.
Yeah.
This is also something, I think it premiered in the Super Bowl maybe 10 years ago. And yeah, we have to go to the YouTube archives mm-hmm. for this one. But it was the EDS, or is it EDS? The Cats commercial.
Cat herders, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for anyone listening, go to YouTube. Is it Electronic Data System?
I think it was EDS, yeah.
EDS. And it was much like the spot you talked about. Mm-hmm. It had these guys on horses, and it was, they didn't break character. They were real cat herders, and they're out on the plains, and meow, and it shows the cats going over. It's like, this is a tough business. And then it showed one guy getting scratched, and when you get a herd in, it feels good. And for me,
funny commercial.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you must have seen the new Cadillac commercial that's getting all the hype now. The
sure,
electronic. It feels like that is a ripoff of Shaving Club. Have you seen the online version of Shaving Club for men, where it shows I own shave, and it's like these quick edits, mm-hmm. and then the quick it's produced in a way that is kind of like this quick edit thing, and so. The Cadillac commercial, aside from the fact that it really does paint kind of an interesting social observation about, in America, we should all aspire to have Cadillacs, because mm-hmm. either it's got this gecko greed is good, and we work hard, we deserve nice things. But from a creativity standpoint, it's kind of an interesting spot.
Yeah, no doubt. I was on a radio show a couple of weeks ago. We talked about that spot exclusively, and it was a very interesting commercial. I think it succeeded in many ways because it's gotten so much attention, first of all. And it definitely pushes buttons, you know, and it has a patriotic message, whether you agree with that message or not.
Right.
The target market for that particular vehicle probably by and large agrees with that message. And, you know, Cadillac is in a position where they have to make an impact, you know. Their commercials have to make an impact. And that actor, Neil McDonough, I mean, he's, you know, he pulls that role off amazingly well. And, you know, my wife wants to turn the channel whenever it comes on, but...
Well, it's one of those spots where you both like and hate at the same time, because you recognize that there's some human emotion you should be having that's a little bit repulsed.
Right.
Because it is about American exceptionalism and
yep.
consumerism. And he's in a big house, and his kids are watching the big TV. And mm-hmm. It's another one of those things for any listeners. Go to YouTube and punch in Cadillac controversial electric car commercial.
Yeah. Poolside, I think it's called.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It starts out with him by the pool.
It's got a few logical inconsistencies, I think. He starts out saying, why are we working so hard? Is it for stuff? You know, and then he says, it's not for stuff. It's because that's just who we are. But at the end, he says, well, it's for stuff.
Yeah, but the edits in the dialogue is like, we went to the moon, and you know what we did when we got there? Nothing. We were bored. And we left a car there. And
see,
it was
see,
like,
we're reciting the dialogue, which means it was well written.
I know. Well, it's your job. You're a journalist. You should. I don't know why I am. I'm not a particular fan of Cadillac. We've got Tim Nutt here. Talk a little bit about in the media creative business, how the internet and how viral videos have played an increasingly big role in the last 10 years, because it was always about TV spots being 30s or maybe a 60 or really 29 seconds, 0.1 or something with the fade in and out. And now with the internet, there's an awful lot of creativity and an awful lot of investment, and a lot of brands are really focusing on internet digital content that's either longer form or gives them more flexibility in terms of ratings, that type of thing. And how do you see, in your experience, that changing brand communication going from broadcast to digital?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I think every brand has a story to tell, and before they had to tell that story in predetermined, you know, lengths, right? 30s, 60s, 15s, whatever.
Right.
You know, you can't afford to buy 2 minutes on American Idol, so you had to do it in 30 seconds. Now, with the internet, you can tell any length of story you like, and it can find its own audience just because it's available to everybody. So that really has changed the game. And if you look at a lot of brand storytelling lately, it has been longer stuff. And I mentioned the Johnny Walker thing. That would never have been possible before the internet. Things like Chipotle, which, you know, had a pretty amazing commercial a couple of years ago with it was an animated spot, and it had Willie Nelson covering that Coldplay song.
Right.
That actually did run once on the Grammys, but only after it blew up online, and it was only intended to be online first. You know, the downside of that freedom, if you like, is that, you know, now every brand goes to their agency and says, get me a viral video, which, you know, isn't necessarily right for every brand, first of all, but it's definitely changing the, you know, it's changed the game drastically for advertisers. And it, you know, it gives creatives a chance to kind of spread their wings too a little bit and write stuff that's longer and maybe a little bit more complex and a little bit more thought-provoking than your typical 30-second ad. And, you know, you can look at the Super Bowl. I think the preponderance of 60s and 90s and even 120s on the Super Bowl lately is a direct result of longer-form content doing well online.
And you're also
seeing a lot of 30s, and it's not so much, you know, very few 30s on the Super Bowl now.
And you're seeing a lot of the long form creatives moving into movies and TV shows, right?
That's right. And, you know, the LA ad scene is exploding lately, and it's because they have access to Hollywood. And there's been a lot of deals lately between marketers and studios, you know, TV and movie studios to, you know, I mean, it's all about, you know, making content that people want to consume and not interrupting them with that content. And it can't really look like advertising, you know, because people get turned off by advertising. Entertainment, Hollywood, and Madison Avenue coming together more than ever these days.
We've talked about the creative side quite a bit about advertising. We have Tim Nutt here. He is a senior editor for Adweek. Talk about the distribution channels, literally and figuratively, for advertising. So whether it's a 30-second spot, whether it's a print ad, whether it's visual, audio, motion. So, you know, creativity is evolved where it's going to evolve today, and it'll continue to evolve. But how that creativity is the transaction between the message and the viewer or the consumer of the message has changed, obviously, with computers, the internet, with iPhones, that type of thing. How much of a change do you think that evolution has had in the last decade relative to advertising? And where do you see the next big step and the next big frontier? Is it going to be Google Glass, where you get down the street and you're going by a Chipotle, and all of a sudden the Google Glass knows from your GPS sensor you're close by, and it knows that you really like the chicken burrito, and really, who doesn't, right? Because I had one 2 days ago. It's so delicious.
Right.
But it knows that you haven't consumed a chicken burrito for 4 days, and so you're ripe for a chicken burrito, and it sends up, and you may need a little inducement. So it may say, come in right now and you're going to get 99 cents for a free soft drink with your chicken burrito. Where do you see the – I may have answered my own question. That's the next
step. Just keep going.
Let's keep going. I've just designed the whole future. We need to call Adweek right now. Hold the presses. But where do you see technology and changes happening with the delivery of all these messages?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. So – 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right, your job as an advertising creative was to come up with a big TV idea. And then that big TV idea would be iterated in a billboard and a print ad as well. And now that system just doesn't really work anymore because all sorts of other mediums are at least as important as television. I mean, television is still huge, don't get me wrong. Good, great TV idea, well executed, is still going to beat any other media. But what's happening now is you can reach consumers all over the place, you know, through their smartphones, you know, on the web, not just in front of the TV. And so, you know, it's not a video first strategy necessarily for most advertisers now. And you talk about, you know, what you're basically talking about is stuff happening outside the home, right? Like Chipotle right. comes to you with you're passing by. I mean, that all that stuff sounds, you know. Everyone mentions Minority Report and all that, but that stuff's going to be real and it's going to become less of a novelty in future. So you will be driving down the highway and your cell phone, unless you're, you know, super concerned about your privacy and you turn off these settings. I mean, your cell phone's going to tell the billboard who you are, and the billboard is going to change depending on who you are. And, you know, if you're heading to vacation by the shore, it'll probably tell you to get off at the next exit if you want, you know, knowing that you've been to certain restaurants in the past. And, you know, it's changing the whole business. And I think there's a certain reluctance among the public to embrace that. They think it's sort of big brotherish and strange. And it is going to depend on the execution, I think. And there's going to be some clumsy attempts at first. But it's all going to sort of smooth out. And hopefully it'll self-regulate and it'll be a win-win.
So you say, Tim Nunn. So you say. But we were joking earlier about NSA, right? I've got your bio here. Yep. And so... At this point, anyone in the world that is a radio host that's about to have Tim Nunn on the show can Google you, find out a bunch of your articles, find out what you did 7 years ago, which was fast. I'm kidding, of course. But can find out about you or anyone else or anything else or anything like that. But you said something interesting a minute ago. You said, the business is going to change. My concern, and maybe it's just the natural human condition, it's not the business that's changing that concerns me, because institutionally businesses and capital go where it goes, where there's profitability and return. It's the human behavior. It's our sense of humanity. And now I sound like my parents or my grandparents when I was a kid saying the Beatles on Ed Sullivan were going to corrupt me and Elvis Presley was going to, you know, do retina damage right. because of his inappropriate dance moves. But I have three kids, and we just went away on vacation, and, you know, they all have iPhones, and they're all Instagramming and tweeting, and they're all – people are it's not just the information's coming in a different way. It's creating this change where now people are either connecting with or volunteering information or being more and more vulnerable, whether it's Facebook, you know, having personal details, where you're eating, what you're doing. Mm-hmm. We're losing senses of boundaries in some ways. And I'm not blaming advertising, but it's such a powerful force in our culture. Do you think that's just a natural change, or do you think that we should write some articles alerting people to this new phenomena that I've identified?
Well, I think, first of all, it's going to happen whether you like it or not. Whether you know, people not liking it doesn't mean it's not going to happen or that they're going to be able to stop it. So I think the key is to monitor it and advocate for the good stuff and then, you know, reject the oversteps. And, you know, it's a hot topic right now. I mean, at South by Southwest, they had Assange and Snowden both spoke by satellite to South by Southwest. And that's, you know, that's all about privacy. And it's all about, where do you draw the line? Like, for sure, companies like Google are advertising companies. I mean, they're getting your information so they can sell you stuff. That's basically all they do. They might provide some interesting email software in the meantime or whatever else you need to get through your digital day. They want to sell to you. And to me, you know, working in advertising, covering the advertising business, everybody wants to sell to you. So I don't think people are have too much to worry about. I mean, I think the privacy question is important. I think it's going to shake out, you know, and I think companies are going to have to play by the right rules. But, you know, to me, it doesn't make any sense to just sort of turn away and pretend it doesn't exist. If you cover it as a journalist, it's my, you know, responsibility to cover it properly and keep people informed. And as a consumer, it's your responsibility to know what's happening with your data.
Well, let's add a third element beyond just the content provider of commercials or information or the content consumer, which is the consumer, and talk for a couple minutes about government policy. You know, obviously when mass media relative to measured media like TV and radio, that's all that existed. It was all under kind of the purview of FCC. And like this radio, this broadcast station here, WLOB, it operates on a license, and that license mandates that certain rules are followed. You can't say certain words. You have to do station ID. You have to do. So in our non-digital world, there's been a lot of thoughtful evolution of how communication is conveyed, and the government, right or wrong, or maybe overreaching or not overreaching, has played an active role. Mm-hmm. It feels like the government and policy setting is way behind on the digital age, mm-hmm. because, first of all, it's not contained within our borders here in the U.S., so it's global, and it's nothing that – and it doesn't have physical parameters like a broadcast signal or a newspaper or magazine. Do you see any areas where you think that government policy needs to be more active in terms of communication relative to advertising? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's certainly an interesting question. I have three kids, so I have a vested interest in you know, how they're being communicated to and sold to. Obviously, I wish my DC bureau chief was here to talk to you about this stuff, because she writes about this stuff daily. I mean, sure, there needs to be you need to keep, you know, your kids safe, and you need to keep people from being exploited and ripped off. And I think you're right. I think the safeguards are not fully in place yet, but hopefully they will be. And you know, I certainly think it's on the government to make sure that happens.
You can always have faith in the government.
Absolutely.
I actually do have faith. I work in local government, and but any giant enterprise has flaws and inefficiencies. So when people say, "Oh, the government messes this up," or somebody will get a tax refund check for $80 billion, and they'll be like, "See, that's evidence." That happens in the law of large numbers. That there's always something. But
privacy is a huge issue in advertising. Not my area of expertise, but we write stories on Adweek.com. You know, weekly about that, and it's a fascinating, you know, topic to watch.
By the way, we have Tim Nunn here. He is senior editor for Adweek. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, talking about FCC regulations. News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. You can follow Tim on his Twitter handle, which is @Nudd, N-U-D-D. You can also go to adfreak.com, which is a blog for Adweek, and then also adweek.com. In the remaining couple of minutes, I wanted to ask you a question that has nothing to do with advertising. It has to do with in addition to your role with Adweek, you're also a contributing writer for People magazine. Mm-hmm. The Kardashians.
The Kardashians, yes.
Yes. How do we get less Kardashian in our culture? And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek question, because I have nothing personally against the Kardashians, mm-hmm. but at some point between the Honey Boo Boos, the Kardashians, mm-hmm. the Swamp People, the Duck Dynasty guy, mm-hmm. who said some things that I was personally offended, mm-hmm. we've gotten to a point where I don't think we should ever restrict free speech within certain parameters in terms of censorship but what is happening with the culture of celebrity, mm-hmm. and what type of personal responsibility do you take, Tim Nunn, as a contributing writer for People magazine?
Celebrity culture is out of control, for sure. I mean, there's no doubt. You know, celebrity. I mean, the funny thing about celebrities is they're supposed to be the most fascinating people that you could ever know, right?
Right.
That's what celebrity was all about. And you know, you're supposed to celebrate them. That's where the whole word comes from.
Right.
And unfortunately, they are fascinating now, but for the wrong reasons. And you know, it's become this sort of train wreck.
Not always accomplishment or achievement. It's something else.
Sure.
You have 19 kids and you're famous. You
right,
make a sex tape and you're famous.
And you're famous. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's what people are interested in. And people are interested in, I think it used to be people were interested in stories that were sort of uniformly uplifting. And now I think that there is a certain amount of, schadenfreude on the part of the consumer where they're fascinated by people who are, making fools of themselves. And that's not necessarily new, but I think the business end of consumer, of celebrity journalism has sort of been leaning in that direction for a while.
But is it a race to the bottom? Because, and I'm not saying this particularly about People magazine, which is one of the more respected weekly magazines, but it feels like whether it's in the print form or whether it's in television or digital, the commercial argument is we have to provide a product that the public wants to the highest degree, and that creates advertising revenue, which is the fuel for the enterprise to do the thing we're doing. And if we don't deliver the thing the public wants, the fuel is cut off and the enterprise ends, and there's no real nobility in that.
Yep.
And that becomes the race for more Honey Boo Boo stories.
That's right. And People's caught up in that for sure. I mean, I think they do have significantly higher standards than most of their competitors.
Right.
They recently signed a deal. They will not publish photos of celebrities' children. Unless the celebrities bring them to official events where they know they will be photographed,
so paparazzi shots of Tom Cruise and his baby on the beach or something.
You will not see a photo
that's great
like that in People. So that's just one example of a line that's maybe arbitrary, but probably important in the long run. The consumer unfortunately will decide if the consumer really needs to see the photo of the baby on the beach, then the consumer will probably buy Us or Life and Style or whatever these other magazines are.
Right.
If they respect People's position, if they even know about it, part of it's a PR issue, they'll hopefully buy People instead. And, I like to think that there's always going to be backlash to oversteps. And I think that, this is one example of that. And, I think People's fairly upstanding. Of course, they have to cover Kim Kardashian like everyone else has to cover her, but I think they've got a right to be, more proud of their work than some.
Hey, Tim, this has been great. We've run out of time. Love to have you come by sometime. You're just down the road, and now that you know where our global headquarters and our broadcast center is.
Yes, absolutely.
Feel free if you ever need to use a broadcast center for any of your journalistic endeavors, you're welcome to do so.
I really appreciate that.
And I'd love to have you come back sometime.
Thank you, Steve.
Tim Nutt here in the studio, senior editor for Adweek. You can read his work at Adweek. You can go to their blog, which is at adfreak.com, or follow him on Twitter at Nudd, which is N-U-D-D. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Thank you for listening.